This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station. Night School on BFM 89.9.
Hi, I'm Sharad Kutin, and welcome to the show that walks you through some fundamental concepts in the social sciences and humanities. Together with Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, the show tries to reveal how various thinkers have grappled with theories and concepts to best understand how society works. Each week, Fuad or I will lead a discussion on a concept or a classic text, which we hope will shed light on the world around you. This week, the onerous duty of explaining a concept falls on my narrow shoulders. I mean, you know, Fuad, you've been taking the burden the last couple of weeks, so it's my turn again. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to be talking about the work by Brazilian dramatist Augusto Boal, and the work is called The Theatre of the Oppressed. There might be echoes or something else in there.
The work by Paulo of the Oppressed. That's what struck me immediately when I heard the title.
Right. And so it does come out of that time, out of the 70s, out of South America, and particular struggles were going on that continent. You know, many governments were turning right wing, and dictatorships were establishing themselves, and popular revolutions were crushed, the Chilean one in particular.
Yeah, it was a very interesting time in South America where I think liberation theology was starting to pick up as well. Just for some context, I think most of our listeners are familiar with theatre. But who is Boal referring to when he mentions the oppressed in the title?
Well, Boal's a Marxist. I mean, that's very clear. And he's referring to workers. I think he's also referring to the popular class of the oppressed in, say, in a continent like South America, and also the peasantry. Basically, you have in South America at that time a very small elite, you know, who are exploiting a large mass of people, both urban-based workers and also rural peasantry. So that's the general shape of things. And it's also very important to note that this work actually develops over time. It is not something he wrote at one go, and it's something that I think evolves, because so much of the work is about practice. Mm-hmm. And so much of the insight that he draws from reading the other important texts with regard to theatre comes from actually doing stuff and making theatre and then coming to some sort of realisation where he's going.
Interesting. And from what I recall, you told me that you performed in a production that was inspired by the book?
Yeah, it was well, you see, out of the book comes particular methodologies, and one of them was forum theatre. And many years ago, in the early 90s, I was an actor in a forum theatre production in Singapore. The directors had gone to New York and studied under Boal. Mm-hmm. He had a workshop there and learnt this particular technique. So, yeah, so for me, there's some connections. But as an actor, I was encouraged to read the book. In fact, I think I read an essay that's not strictly this book. So it's a work specific to forum theatre. But I've gone back to the original text, the main kind of philosophical foundations for much of Boal's thinking about theatre. Mm-hmm. And it also comes out of my concern about political art and, you know, wanting to understand what does it mean to talk about the political in art? Mm-hmm. Is it about the message? Is it about the medium? Mm-hmm. Is it about the way in which, and I think this is Boal's point, it's the structuring of our experience when we observe art, especially theatre. Mm-hmm. So part of the Boal's thesis was developed while he was in exile. And it's an interesting little quote in the more recent edition of the work, and he talks about how he looks at these questions. He says, and I'm quoting him here, he says, "When I read this book today, I do so from a much broader perspective than I did when I wrote it. At that time, I was concerned with theatre as theatre and about its relationship to social human beings. Now, I'm more concerned with human beings as theatre." Now, he's just signaling a shift. So I guess he's looking at the what you might call the performative elements of social life, mm-hmm, how do we interact in real life, how we kind of perform our sense of being, you know, mm-hmm, how we perform who we are and our identities and such. But in this thing, he's actually looking at theatre as such.
I see. I'm interested on that point about how we perform in sort of our everyday social relations. Is that a conscious decision that we adopt to perform certain social roles, or is it something that is more subconscious?
Well, you know, there are sociologists who have taken this issue up, who look at the way in which we perform. Mm-hmm. We perform our identities, we perform our roles, and there is a level of conscious self-creation mm-hmm. in social life, in being a social and cultural being. Mm-hmm. So, I think, that's a whole new different field.
Sure.
You know, something we probably should take up at some mm-hmm, point. Mm-hmm.
That's interesting, though. Yeah.
The other thing I wanted to point out about this book, and I think it's part of our series, is really to encourage people to read. Mm-hmm. And this book is very readable. Even though some of the subject matter is quite substantial and it's difficult, it's really part of a Western intellectual canon. You go through Aristotelian poetics to, you know, the work of Hegel to Brecht and so forth. But he does say at one point, and you can see it, it's a joy to read. He mm-hmm. says, he kind of criticizes himself. He says, and I'm quoting Boal here, he says, "Aristotle wasn't as plain-spoken as I've made him out to be. He was well-educated, used to reading between the lines and spotting nuances. As for poor old me, I come from Peña, a working-class area in the north of Rio de Janeiro, where we call a spade. So I have to be more direct, more objective. I have to tell the brutal truth. It's my destiny. I'm condemned to speak clearly," he says. Mm-hmm. And there's this kind of dramatic quality about the text that I think is a real invitation to read it.
Is it arranged chronologically, as in to tell a history of theatre?
In part, but the history is, and I can tell a little bit about the structure. So he mm-hmm. goes from an analysis of a Greek theater to looking at some of the conceptual foundations of that, and then going to the work of the German philosopher Hegel, and then looking at, and this is what we're going to be looking at. He also actually has a whole chapter on Machiavelli, but he looks at it from a conceptual point of view. He's not just kind of drawing out in a descriptive fashion. He's looking at what is it that drove their ideas of theater, mm-hmm. of art, you know, and it really goes to some very fundamental concepts, you know, in Western philosophy. So, what is his key argument? And when you listen to the argument, you have to think about the stage. You have to think about the literal stage, what they call in Western theater proscenium art stage. You know, it's got a space that where actors act, and there's a space where audiences sit. That mm-hmm. kind of space. Now, this, of course, is something that developed. It wasn't always like that. And I think when you read the chapter on the development of theatre in the context of Greece, you get to see exactly what he means by this, why he's disturbed by the politics that is emerging around theatre in the period of, you know, classical antiquity.
Mm-hmm. So what was it like in Greece that so differed with the contemporary setting in theatre?
Well, see, in Greece, what you have is, initially, you can imagine peasant society, you have overlords, it's a feudal society, sure. right? So workers are the strict and systematic control of their bodies around the production of food or grain or whatever. But at the end of the harvest, there is an opening up, a celebration. Now, these things, the feudal overlords could not control, they couldn't stop. Right. And so you have, especially along with alcohol, a great kind of exuberant outburst of people's emotions. Now, what Boal is saying is that those in power knew that this was a very disturbing force mm-hmm. and that needed to be controlled somehow. So in taking the kind of unstructured, unscripted dancing and revelry, they created a tradition of a theater, of dance, of movement, of voice that was more scripted.
I see. Okay,
and so
interesting.
Yeah, so theater kind of develops out of this need to control the script. So there's a script, and the script is in the hands of something called the chorus.
So in other words, he's saying that the birth of the concept of theater itself was as a mechanism of control.
Absolutely. Wow. That he in fact, and you'll see what he does is he says, okay, so there was this guy called Thespis, right? So he's part of the chorus, but he was also a guy who wrote the stuff, and he jumps out of the chorus And he jumps out the chorus in front of a particular king. This king is kind of well known in Greek history. And what he does is he starts to speak directly to the audience. He speaks without a script. And the king at the end of the performance says, well, okay, I see what you're doing. It's kind of exciting for the audience. But actually, this is very dangerous and I want you to stop. Mm. Now, Thespis can't stop himself. I mean, he's driven by these passions. He likes what he's doing. So what he does is he develops a character, a protagonist that is separate from the chorus. Okay? Mm-hmm. And now the protagonist, in order not to be Thespis, has to don costume and a mask, because Thespis is the originator of the mask mm-hmm. in the Greek tradition. And he becomes something other than himself. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay. Now, this is all kind of good, because somehow Thespis has recovered that initial impulse to be outside the chorus, outside the script. And it's then kind of pulled back by this strategy of, okay, you can't really go against the people in power. So what do? How do you make a distinction between yourself as actor and the character you're playing? Now, there's another problem, okay? Mm-hmm. And this is something Aristotle then theorizes. Now, that's what Aristotle is called, one of the great touchstones of, you know, Western philosophy, mm-hmm. right? Plato was very suspicious of theater. He wanted famously to ban it, right?
Yep.
And because I think poetry and theater, all these things are kind of like all in the mix, right? But Aristotle says, no, we don't have to ban it. What we have to recognize is what's happening between the audience and the protagonist. Now, what Aristotle says is happening is that there is an identification between the audience and the protagonist. And that has to be not suppressed, but to remold it. So, mm-hmm. so Aristotle has this really ingenious way in which he takes this identification and he subverts it mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. by creating a protagonist who ultimately is flawed. So this is the nature of the Aristotelian framework for theatre. The protagonist is flawed, and that by the end of the production, we in the audience must understand that he was mistaken. And we are allowed to, we are released from this identification through what they call catharsis. Mm-hmm. Now, you'll notice all these words, they're actually a part of the way we talk about the world, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, well, some
people. I think
absolutely,
so, yeah.
Right? So that's his starting point. The starting point was, this is the genesis of Western theater.
Mm.
Control. And then impulses, very strong impulses to break that control, and then that reabsorption into some form of control at a higher level. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Boal never says, oh, we must return to that crazy, unscripted way of living our lives. Mm-hmm. I mean, for him, it's not about saying, well, you know, we should have remained in that state.
Right.
It's about recognizing that control has shifted and finding a way to address that issue of control at that new level. Mm-hmm. I think that's mm-hmm. how best to understand kind of Boalian strategy.
Well, that's a very interesting account of the origins of, at least in a Western setting, of theatre. But, you know, back then, when I think of ancient Greece, theatre was a central form of entertainment. And now it's become a bit more marginal, right? What radical potential does it still have?
Yeah, okay. So, when he's discussing theatre, he's mm-hmm. actually looking at particular forms of ritual, particular ways in which the state and the elite relate to the masses. All these things are still in culture in different forms.
Sure,
so,
right.
You know, I think Boal is not simply committed to the idea of theatre.
Performance in general, I think, is what he's aiming for.
That's right. Performance, all kinds of performances. And also an understanding of the way in which society represents itself to itself, as it were. You know, and so here you have an analysis of theatre that really is much more than just saying, how do we make more entertaining theatre? And that's why I would recommend this book highly.
I see. And I think what you described there is very, very interesting, because I mean, just look at how the media conditions our life and how appearance and the way we talk to other people or the way politicians relate to us, all of that has performative elements. right? Yeah. And it's very central to how we think of what's right and wrong and who to vote for and, you know, what to aim for as a better society, so on and so forth.
Yeah. Right. And one of the central things, and that's something we come back to, is this idea of dialogue. Once the protagonist is separated from the chorus, once you have several characters on stage, you have dialogue. Now, dialogue, again, is very dangerous. So you think of Athenian society, you know, of democracy, but who gets to speak? Now, the question of who gets to speak is something that is at the heart of Boal's politics in terms of theatre making.
Interesting.
Okay, up next, more on Boal's Theatre of the Oppressed. Boal is a Brazilian theatre practitioner. I'm Sharad Kutin with Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, and this is Night School on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, this is Night School. I'm Sharad Kutin with Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, and we're talking about the text The Theatre of the Oppressed by Augusto Boal, a Brazilian dramatist. In the first part, I outlined what I understood to be Boal's sense of Greek theatre and the politics behind Greek theatre. And I just wanted to do two things. I want to actually introduce some of the key terms that he used very quickly. We talked about the protagonist. The protagonist, remember, comes out of the chorus being the script that is kind of given and usually expresses the interests of society as a whole and the ruling class. Mm-hmm. Right. Empathia is that thing that marries the spectator, the audience, to the protagonist. Because the protagonist is comes out of the script and is so exciting and speaks truth to power or is, you know, funny or whatever, we in the audience tend to identify with it. Mm-hmm. Now, this the Greeks call, or Aristotle in particular, called a mistaken identification, and he gave it a word, hamartia, I think is how you pronounce that. I actually don't know how to speak Greek. But anyway, and...
Sounds close enough.
Yeah. Aristotle, what he does is he then says, okay, in order to deal with these new emerging impulses in society, what we cannot do is to suppress it, as Plato had suggested. He says we need to work with it. And he worked with it by saying what has to happen to the protagonist is he has to suffer a reversal of fortune, and that we call peripeteia. Mm-hmm. And at the end of this, you have a moment in the play or in the story that allows the audience to finally distance itself from the protagonist through an act of catharsis. So that's the way in which the Greek theatre worked. Mm-hmm. Now, let me read something from the book, okay? The unruly protagonist separated himself from the chorus. He rebelled. The mask hid the actor behind the character. Realistic theatre melded the two together again, dissolving the actor who was subjected to the emphatic command of the character. Brecht proposed to separate actor and character once again, so that the spectator could contemplate both of them at the same time and wonder, me or him. But Brecht eventually accepted the marriage of the poet through the actor and the spectator, who continued to supervise in the same way as husbands once did to wives in old-fashioned marriages. The poet wears the trousers and says what goes. The spectator is still cast as an old-fashioned wife. Mm-hmm. You see, in both these thinkers, the concern is the person sitting in the dark, still and observing the experience, as we do when we're at cinema.
Right.
We're enthralled. Mm-hmm. And that was a problem for both Boal and Brecht, because Boal comes after Brecht.
Sure.
But what Brecht does, which Boal notes, is that Brecht says the way to do this is to kind of demystify the experience. You know, I mean, this is the thing that art does. It's actually an experience.
Sure,
it's an experience of the world. The world is being presented to us in new ways. And one of the things that happens in theatre is we are enthralled by it, right? Mm-hmm. And we connect to the actor. We are, and the classic term is this, you know, temporary suspension of disbelief. You know, it's not Tom Cruise out there. It's not Brad Pitt. It's this person. And we can cry with him.
We can identify with Tom Cruise in that moment. Yeah.
Right. So what the Brechtian strategy is to break that. To break that identification. Kind of like constantly show us that this is theatre. But Boal's concern is that what really happens is the director is now leading the audience by structuring the experience such and say, okay, I'm telling you what the story is. So it's different from an older form of theater where people are enthralled and mesmerized and whatnot. Mm-hmm. But it's still one in which the spectator is passive, mm-hmm. silent, and being led. Mm-hmm. Okay? Now,
what's the uptake, though? What's the import here? I mean, I know Brecht is a Marxist, too.
Yes, he is. And yeah. Boyle actually is critical of his, one, his vocabulary, and that's a long kind of side argument. But uh-huh. it's also about the end result. Because for Boyle, when you understand exactly where the politics is, then you create a theater that is responsive to that politics, mm-hmm. right? So in some ways, he thinks of Brecht's theater as inadequate. I mean, this might be my gloss on it, but I think that's what he would say. Now, the very important things that come out of this discussion, and this is kind of a series of counterpoints that come out between what they call an idealist notion of art or poetics, of aesthetics, and one that is Marxist or radical. We have a list of counterpoints. I can't go through all of them, but I did want to point to some of the main ones. One is, what is it that is at the center of these dramatic productions? In an idealist poetics, it's the character as subject. And here, subject has a specific meaning. It means you are the originating, thinking, shaping impulse of the world. Mm-hmm. You have subjectivity. Right. You have subjecthood. You have agency, mm-hmm. right? Whereas in a kind of a properly Marxian thing, the character isn't a subject. Mm-hmm. The character is an object. An object of social forces. Being,
right.
Right? I mean, it's kind of classic Marxist in that sense, right?
So what this means, just to think out loud, is that in the, I guess, the more radical Marxist brand of poetics, the character is a kind of an outcome of society, in a way, right?
Absolutely.
Rather than this kind of isolated individual.
Or more importantly, a heroic individual, which you always have, you know? So when you have a war film, the film really is not there to explain to you how millions were caught up in this war.
Right.
What was driving it? Was it the search for oil, for instance? Or was it, you know, expansion, the need for labor?
It's depoliticized in that sense.
Absolutely. Yep. And then it resides on individuals, a band of brothers you know, something like that, right? Yeah. So they become the motive force. They become the driving force for the action, the dramatic action of the play of or mm-hmm. whatever. Mm-hmm. Now, so some of the interesting counterpoints you'll see in popular culture today. Things like, on one hand, idealist poetics has, as he says, the conflict of free wills impels the dramatic action. The structure of the work is a scheme of wills in conflict. So mm-hmm. it's individuals.
Right.
Right. Whereas the radical reading would be that what you actually have at the center that pushes the dramatic action forward is contradictions at an economic, social level of political forces. The question is how do you translate that? I mean, this is easier to represent human beings. How do you represent?
It's more of a challenge. You can always just talk about stories about individuals having disagreements or something, but to bring the larger social picture into these characters, it's, you know, it takes a lot of skill. I imagine.
Absolutely. Yeah. So the second counterpoint would be that in an idealist poetics, you have action, and the action is present. You feel like you're in the moment. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the representation of reality in a radical poetics, you actually have a sense that this is a narrative. Mm-hmm. You're being told this is a narrative.
Right, right. So, I mean, clearly the running theme in the Brechtian sort of radical aesthetics here is that it's consciousness raising.
Absolutely.
Right? You're not just telling a story in the abstract. You're talking about stories that are supposed to shape the audience's perspective on society.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the interesting examples I gave for a kind of pre-Brechtian notion of this kind of aesthetic or poetics was a production that was done in New York, and but it was set in a different time. And in order to help the audience not misunderstand that this was about another time, the director actually had an exhibition about Nazi Germany. It was done in, you know, in the middle of the 20th century to show. They say, well, hold on, don't get lost in the drama, you know? Right. And this is very interesting, kind of a different take on what entertainment or art in this case really ought to be. It's really not trying to trick you into believing something that's not there. Mm-hmm. It's doing just the opposite, right? Mm-hmm. So, okay, so you have on one hand, you have action that's present as opposed to a presentation of a narrative. And in the end, in an idealist notion, you have a resolution of conflict. Whereas for the radical tradition, you want to leave that conflict unresolved. What you want is a greater clarity about the contradictions that produce that action.
Right. And presumably the audience would leave the theatre with a greater sense of injustice. Something has to be done because the tension isn't resolved.
It's not resolved on stage. It's supposed to be resolved in real life.
Right.
And so, you know, the last point would be that a kind of idealist theatre arouses feelings, whereas in a radical theatre, it demands that the audience makes decisions.
This is really fascinating. And I just can't help wondering if you were in the theatre scene before. Has anybody attempted this in Malaysia? Do you know of any projects that experimented with this form?
Yeah, I think there have been. And, you know, discussions. See, this is the part of the problem, I think, sometimes is that in wanting to do political theatre, and there are groups that want to do that, they sometimes don't read the theory. And when you don't read the theory, you don't understand where the politics really is. And so often people think that the politics is in the message. So you have a progressive, radical, whatever message it is. The politics is in the message, not in the form.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I try to explain towards the end of this. I'll just give you a very brief account of a production of Forum Theatre. You'll see that the politics is really in the structuring of that space,
right,
in the structuring of theatre, and helping the person in the audience rethink their relationship to reality, rethink their relationship to this, so they no longer remain passive.
Right. It's not just to give them a new idea or something. It's to elicit some sort of outrage or some sense of injustice.
Yeah. But you see, there's of course this classic thing called agitation propaganda theatre, or agit prop as they call it, you know, or in anything, you know. And there, again, it's a very strong sense of arousing feelings, but with a radical purpose, right? So it's agitation propaganda, right? You've got the emotive part there, you got the message part of there, and it's been used by radical groups to make perhaps good to some effect.
Yeah, and as you were explaining that, I was the little devil / liberal on my shoulder was saying, well, you know, liberals will say, I don't want any propaganda. I just want a story, you know. They always think, you know, that's their natural response.
And I'll quote something from Boal that that sounds perhaps a little like that. He says, it is not the place of theatre to show the correct path, but only to offer the means by which all possible paths may be examined. Now, so this is...
That's a break from Brecht a bit, right?
He definitely is critical of the Brechtian resolution of the problem. And he's seeking his own. And, you know, what he wants to do is, because as I said before, he believes that he who speaks has power. And so he wants to bring the audience onto the stage. I read a little bit of a manifesto that he has, and he says, I, Augusto Boal, want the spectator to take on the role of actor and invade the character and the stage. I want him to occupy his own space and offer solutions. The stage is a representation of reality, a fiction, but the spect actor, a word that he coins, is not fictional. He exists in the scene and outside of it in a dual reality. Okay, let me tell you what a forum theatre production would be like.
Okay.
You basically have a short story. You have a scene, and in the scene you have somebody who's oppressed, perhaps a worker having to work, you know, a 12-hour shift, and the characters in it all represent the main stakeholders in that person's environment. Now that is played to the audience. There are moderators, they call them jokers. Now the jokers that are there to keep things in line. I'll tell you what happens. The audience can stop the action and say, I want to play the role of the oppressed. So they step into the role. So it's participative. You know, there's element of it. But this is not theatre games. They get into it, and then they have to deal with it. So they have to offer solutions to that person's oppression. Now, what they cannot do, and the Joker is there to remind them, they cannot introduce magic. Now, magic is something you'll all be familiar with. It comes from Hollywood. Magic is, I win $1 million. Right, I don't have to worry about being an oppressed worker now.
Right.
Yeah, you cannot do that in foreign theater. No magic. So the parameters are there. They're set. But they are, as in real life, they are elastic to some extent. Mm-hmm. You can push up against them.
Are these spectators who volunteer to enter the frame, were they vetted beforehand or it can just happen spontaneously?
No, it happens spontaneously. Wow. I mean, the idea is that, and you know, for what I we did this production in Singapore where people are not known to be like, you know, exuberant and, you know,
yeah, they go in Malaysia.
And it was amazing, you know, yeah. and the thing about this is it's a short story, so everybody hears it,
right?
And it gets played over and over again. And people kept wanting to step into that person's role. Wow. It's a rehearsal for the future. And that's, in some ways, how Boal thinks about what theatre might be. This is just one of his many experiments, you know. And I think in some ways, it's as a form of philosophical analysis, plus he has a kind of programmatic approach to all this. He's saying, I want to build something on the basis of this analysis that I have.
If I were running something like that, I would worry that that might backfire in a sense that the audience might not really empathize with the worker, the audience member who volunteers.
Yes, but they have to be true to this. See, so, okay, I might say, oh, I'd rather be the oppressive boss.
Yeah.
Okay, that's fine too. Yeah,
okay.
And people can. I mean, it's all a question of how well this is moderated. So the Joker's position.
The Joker's key here, imagine. Yeah.
Yeah. So he or she keeps the action within the frame of something real. Now, as an actor, and I was an actor in this, I had to remember, be true to my character, but I also had to be flexible. I could be persuaded. Because you have an actor who says, the worker says, you know, sir, I really deserve a raise. Yes, you got it. You know, then your action's dead, right? I
mean, right.
You basically you lost
the job. Contradiction. Yeah.
And you need to be true to your character at the same time flexible. And that's real life too. Mm-hmm. People do change. I mean, so a boss, I mean, bosses are not all, you know, one-dimensional caricatures, right? They, even though particular interests speak through them, it doesn't speak in some sort of, you know, unmodulated voice. There are differences. And I think that's something that's very exciting for the theatre and this form of rehearsal that, you know, that Boal calls it. I'm going to quote something that actually comes to the star of the book and it just lays out why this is still relevant to us, even though theatre as a form might be quite marginal. Mm-hmm. And he says, and I'm quoting Boal, he says, what I propose to do in this work is to show that Aristotle constructs the first extremely powerful poetic political system for the intimidation of the spectator, for the elimination of the bad or illegal tendencies of the audience. The system is, to this day, fully utilized not only in conventional theatre, but in the TV soap operas and in Western films as well. Movies, theatre and television united through a common basis in Aristotelian poetics for the repression of the people. Kind of like, you know, it's a call to arms.
Right. I see that.
But
yeah.
It's not simply a call to arms. You know, you have to work through the logic of Western philosophy, its understanding of spirit, of agency, of subject, of object, of the relationships of things that are central, of concepts that are central to Western philosophy to get to the point that he gets, which is the foundations of a new form of theatre.
And I think based on what he describes here, you really see the contours of the idealist aesthetic that, you know, that you described just now, where typically the Hollywood narrative is just that, right? It's always about individuals kind of braving through the world, not really thinking about his social condition or anyone else's social condition for that matter. And we somehow internalize this because we're so exposed to it.
Yeah. And but because, you know, there were competing traditions in, say, in filmmaking that have lost out to this kind of linear narrative films that have come to dominate us. And I think what's important is for us to remember that. There was a whole range of strategies. And I think that's what really is exciting about culture is that culture is in many ways a continual struggle to understand the way we work in the world, to work against that, to work with it.
And the entertainment industry is like a weapon against us. It's like a huge, you know, mean of suppressing our potential.
I mean,
I might take it, I might be taking it too far the Brechtian direction, but you know. the implication is there in a way.
Yeah. And I think, you know, not to dismiss all other forms of theatre. It's just, it's to recognise what was going on that animated the decisions they made. They weren't simply, you know, that the popular forms that we see weren't simply that. I mean, they didn't emerge out of nowhere for no reason. Mm-hmm, they emerge out of specific conditions for specific reasons. Mm-hmm. You know, and that in that sense, Boal's contribution to that ongoing debate about what culture should do in any society, I think, remains very relevant.
Yeah, and man, this is interesting. Thanks for taking us through this.
Well, you were listening to a discussion about Augusto Boal's Theatre of the Oppressed. We could have more discussions on our Facebook page. Fuad and I are trying to get that going. So please join us. All of us are learning every day about these things. I'm no expert on theatre. I picked up the book and I just, you know, put some time away in my day to actually read it and struggled and, you know, got a few headaches in the process.
And we accept emails too. Our email address is bfmnightschool@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. Any thoughts, insights, comments or criticisms are very welcome.
And our Facebook page is BFM Night School. This show will be repeated on Wednesday at 9 p.m. And thank you for joining us. I'm Sharad Kutan with Ahmad Fuad Ramad for Night School on BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.